Joining me now on Fresh Air is African drummer Olatunji, who has become probably the most well-known African drummer to Americans. You may have heard his performances, or seen him on television, or heard Olatunji and his Drums of Passion on record. Well, he'll be with us in just a moment. Olatunji has come to Philadelphia to perform this evening in a concert sponsored by the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum. The concert was originally going to be held right in back of the museum, but because it's raining, it's going to be moved indoors, and the location will be the auditorium of the new Channel 12 building, which is the former Living History Center, which is located on 6th and Ray Streets in Philadelphia. Olatunji will be joined on the program by two African musicians, Bai Kante and his son Dembo Kante, who are two excellent kora players. The kora is an instrument, an African instrument, that is considered to be a predecessor of the guitar. You may remember their recent appearance here on Fresh Air, in which they talked about their music and performed for us as well. So this concert will all happen this evening at the Channel 12 building on 6th and Ray Streets in Philadelphia. Well, before we meet Olatunji and before he does some playing for us live in the studio, let's listen to a record that I bet a lot of you are familiar with. The album is called Olatunji Drums of Passion. It was recorded in 1959, I believe.
Yes.
Let's hear a selection from it.
Thank you.
Music from the album Olatunji, Drums of Passion. Olatunji is in the studio with me now. Again, he's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at a concert sponsored by the Afro-American Cultural and Historical Museum. But the concert will be held because of the rain in the Channel 12 building on 6th and Ray Streets. Well, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a great pleasure to have you here and to meet you after hearing your stuff for many years.
I like the title of your show, Fresh Air. We need fresh air these days.
You were telling me you came to the United States first in 1950. What brought you here?
Well, I came here to whet my appetite for knowledge. And that is to go to college, you know, because in 1950, Nigeria was still under colonial rule. When you finish high school, the only thing you aspire to be is to be to work at the Treasury Department or Public Works Department, just to be a civil servant. But I decided to come over here when I listened to two great Africans who later became the shining light of the political and revolutionary movement in Africa. I listened to Dr. Nkrumah and Dr. Azikiwe of Nigeria. And they stressed that most of us who aspire to go overseas, because there are no institutions, higher institutions of learning in Nigeria, we should stop the exodus of people going to England and coming to the New World. And if we are determined enough, we will be able to achieve whatever goal we set for ourselves. That's how I started.
Has that changed since the time you came here?
Oh, yes, of course. There have been many, many more Africans, not only Nigerians, coming to the United States than in the last 20 years. When I first came, I think probably there went more than probably 50 or 100 African students, and even probably two or three from East Africa completely. But now you have over 5,000 Nigerians in metropolitan New York alone. You have 25,000 Nigerian students studying in the United States, just Nigeria. So the exodus has really been to us here.
Did you expect that your music was going to catch on here the way it did?
To tell you the truth, I didn't, because that's how it started first of all. Can you imagine arriving on the shores of this great nation and had a taste of whatever segregation is. It was new to me completely. You see, there were no Pan Am flying in those days. BOAC probably make one flight once a month. I came by boat. And I came through what they call the West African Bible Line, which the final destination would be New Orleans. So that was a great place to come to, you know, and from there, I took the train to Morehouse College in Atlanta. But the questions that people asked me on the campus, students, they were unbelievable. I had to really sit down and say, now, in order to maintain my sanity, what am I going to do?
What kind of questions were these?
People asked me whether we have lions running on the streets. People, do we eat the same thing people eat here? And I say, how ignorant can even college students be? What has really gone wrong? These are questions that probably that will provoke any person. But at the same time, I say, well, you know, ignorance is a dangerous bliss, and something must be done about it. And this is how I really started into the music. I had no political platform to talk about the ideologies or the tradition. Nobody will listen to me anyway, because Africa was still only Liberia and probably Ethiopia was independent in those days. And you can just imagine what it is, how you feel just coming and see your colleagues, people that you expect to know much better. Then I discovered that this was really due to what I call Hollywood's unholy war on Africa, through their movies, and how people have really completely been brainwashed. Going through a chapter in a book I'm writing now about my experiences here, that our people, both black and white, have undergone what I call a gradual process of peaceful indoctrination. Only a few people have really have the opportunity of reading between the lines. So all they know about Africa is Africa of Tarzan and Jane, Africa of Sabu the Elephant Boy, Africa where you have the headhunters and shrinkers or whatever. There were the books that were written about Africa When you read it, I wouldn't want to associate with any part of Africa myself. But there have been so many good things coming out of Africa for generations, for hundreds of years, and it was deliberate. It was a deliberate attempt to really keep away all those positive things about Africa from the people. So this is how I started. I said, this must change.
So you used your music as a basis for introducing the culture to people as well. How did you start presenting your music, and what kind of context? And did you find other musicians to play with
you? Well, first of all, I started, you know, like I went into myself. And that is when you say go inside into yourself and find out and then be yourself and listen. Be still and know. And the answer will come to you probably how you can handle situations. I say, well, if I'm here for education and if I'm going to be among these people, I really have to get my head straight. I have to deal with them. I'm not going to run away from it, but because I'm going to see what I can bring about an effective change. During the introduction of a freshman get-together, we got a lot of publicity because I came here as a Rotary scholar. I won Rotary scholarship from the Rotary International Organization of Atlanta, Georgia. Can you imagine? In 1950? So that's another interesting part of my whole life. So I said to myself, well, since I can't go and talk about the politics of Africa, we didn't have any because it was colonial. Now I have to really use the tradition. So I was asked to do something during the freshman orientation. So I sang, and I brought a small drum with me, which I still have. It's a clay drum. That's the drum that I'm going to demonstrate on tonight. The forerunner of the tambourine that our people brought here, because the base of it is clay. And this drum, if you know how to play, has so many fantastic rhythmic patterns that we can get on it. And the tonal quality that you get will probably bring you near to what we heard, the Yoruba talking drum. So I played and everybody said, oh my God, this is fantastic. So I asked the band, the school band that was playing, for me to join them, because I noticed that they were playing something like, you know, they were playing calypso tunes. They were playing samba rhythms. I sat in and everybody's, you know, they asked me to take a bow. They just gave me time to take a solo. So every time the band is playing on the campus, I join them. They said, look, we're only getting $25. You're not going to get paid, you know. I said, that's fine. Later on, I hired every one of them. I employed every one of them. Anyway, I started like that. And then I was invited to many tea parties. You know, I went to the churches, you know, because I also grew up, you know, in the area of the African Methodist Episcopalian Church. I was a member of the choir and I played instruments, you know, the percussion instruments in the choir. Sponsor will ask me if I want to speak in different churches, both black and white, and I take my drums to the church. And I sing most of the hymns, you know, and accompany, because most of them are in 4-4 rhythmic pattern anyway, that I will sing like Onward Christian Soldiers in the Yoruba language. And every member of the congregation will recognize it, and they start clapping and singing it in English version. Of course, syncopated, you know, with rhythm, you know. And this is how I went on all over the South.
I'm wondering how you learned how to play drums, because...
Oh, my God.
You learned in Nigeria in a setting that might have been different than the setting in which you have taught people how to play.
Yes. You see, when psychologists and sociologists talk about the significance of the importance of our environment and how we are affected by what our environment has to offer, it is very important that we take a close look at that. Well, I grew up in the village as well as in the city. I was born in a fishing and agricultural village, which is only 40 miles from the capital city. So I'm a village boy as well as a city boy also. But music covers all the vicissitudes of life. When a child is born, there's music and dance. It doesn't have to be a member of your family. In the environment, in the neighborhood, you join in the celebration because this is a celebration of life. When that child reaches the age of puberty, it's celebrated. when he or she has come of age, this is celebrated with music and dance. And there's no way of escaping it when one takes a giant step in life, you know, and that's, I mean, when you get married. Everybody come all over and help you celebrate this giant step in life that you have assumed some another kind of responsibility to building up community and so forth. And when one, you know, join the great majority, they believe that it's only the physical body that is always die and never the spirit. That is also celebrated. So there is no way that we can miss this going on. It's continuous every day because this is the whole process of life because it's like a cycle. And of course, we have sophisticated Africans today probably who they won't be able to sing for you one lullaby. This is what we have to accept because of the process of acculturation that Western civilization has brought to Africa. But at the same time, but the child still has the opportunity to learn, and that's how I learned. And probably you can say that I was more probably inquisitive. I followed the great drummers, you know, the great performers. I helped them carry their instrument to different festivals, you know, 20, 30 miles away on weekends from home. And you watch the masters how they play. And one day they say, look, we've been seeing you hanging around all this time. You know, what can you do? Have you heard anything? You know, so they teach you how to listen first.
It sounds like things in a way were more structured there because if you learned an instrument, there would always be the ceremonies in which you could play. As you said, there was music surrounding everything.
That's right.
Whereas if someone learns music now, it's either a hobby or they become a professional musician and have
and
to worry
you,
about if they're
going
to get enough
booked,
gigs.
Forget
exactly,
about it.
Exactly. So consequently, teaching music to someone becomes a different experience too, I'd imagine, because the person's learning to use music for different reasons.
That's right.
How do you go about teaching people drums now?
Well, I have developed a system of my own over the that came from my experience over the years, and I can really teach someone who has never touched a drum within a month to be able to hold rhythmic patterns and to be able to play on time. And this is through the language, but the person have to really agree to learn the Yoruba language. I've taken from the alphabet and the consonant developed from the alphabet certain sounds that are comparable to all the rhythmic patterns we hear. Like in the Yoruba alphabet or the consonants, you have something like D-O, do, G-O, but it's G, we call it go, it's as in give, it's not, you know, it's go, and then G-U-N, it's not gone, because the last letter of the alphabet, the N, has a nasal sound in all African languages, also in Swahili, so G-U-N will be goon, G-E-N will be gan, you know, which is the base anyway. And you can only get the bass of the drum where? In the middle of the drum. You can never get a bass sound out of the drum except you hit it in the middle. So, and then you have what they call a high tone or high pitch. Pa, which is P-A, pa. That's a consonant in it. Then you have ta, T-A, ta. And then that's a slap, which you call in Latin slap, you know. You say, go do, pa ta. You know, you can reproduce that. You can say gung, godo, that the hand in the middle, left, right, at the edge of the drum.
So you have hooked up the speech that you're using with places on the drum and
that's
with
right.
types of motions, hand
this
motions on
the drum. This takes us back into how the whole idea of the talking drum came about. Because most African languages, practically all of them are rhythmical. And they have high, middle, and low pitches. But Yoruba language is probably one of the most difficult ones, you know, very, very flexible. You can take one word to mean five different things depending on the way you pronounce it. If you take the word O, G, or G, we say, U, N, you know, that's Ogun, Ogun. 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 Ogun, the god of iron. Ogun, war. Ogun, medicine. Ogun, sweat. Ogun, 20.
So it all depends how you say it.
Yes. Well, same inflection in Spanish and French. You see, so we've had all of those things before even Western institutions ever came. So people were able to communicate. Two farmers, you know, who are 1,500 miles apart, of course, you know, not in an industrial situation, because sand travel that far. And they can communicate and tell each other that they are leaving and going home, or so that the other will know that his counterpart is, you know, has left already for home.
That's something that must have really infuriated you about the Hollywood movies, because the talking drums and the Hollywood movers are always the savages declaring war.
Well, communication is probably, as I was talking to Sister Kennedy, you know, I said that what I have observed in the past 25 years of my going back and forth and traveling all over the world, I discovered there's only one thing that remains that we really have to really take a close look at, is that's communications. Sometimes you'll be talking to people and their mind might be somewhere else completely, and what you're telling them really doesn't register or on their mind, or they block it out completely. You know, they really don't want to have, they have preconceived ideas. It's unbelievable.
That's certainly true. Well, Tunji, I'd like to ask you if you could do some playing for us. You have brought this large and very, very beautiful wood-carved drum with you, and I'd love to hear you do some playing on it.
Now, okay, I have a... I was thinking about two different things that I could do before getting here, and then I canceled them out. I was just talking with a friend of mine from Haiti, and just to see how the culture has traveled from Africa to different parts of the world, and how music has become a universal language. Probably the only thing that we have that is not adulterated, that cannot be bastardized, because they are purists, you know, people who really try to keep it that way, the way it has always been, and what it has always meant to people. Every year, the Haitians give a dance in New York, you know, just getting themselves together. And this particular rhythmic pattern is a ritual one. And it's ritualistic in the sense because it tells the story about man's development from childhood into the great beyond. Thank you.
That was nice. I should say that if you want to hear more of Babatunde Olatunji's playing, there's more to be heard this evening at the Channel 12 Auditorium. Let me explain. The Afro-American Cultural and Historical Museum has invited Olatunji to come to Philadelphia to perform tonight at a concert. Now, this is the concert that was at first going to be held right in back of the museum itself, but because of the rain, it's going to be moved indoors to the Channel 12 building, which is the former Living History Center on 6th and Ray Streets. And the concert is scheduled for 7 o'clock. That sounded good. It's so nice to be. I'm really lucky because I get to see your hands and really be close and watch you playing as well as hearing it. The music that you played when you were in Nigeria was in a very ritualistic setting, at least some of the time, performing for ceremonies and stuff. Is it different for you when it's outside of that, when it's a concert setting and there's an audience who sits and listens and there isn't that sense of ritual, but it's rather a performance?
Well, all my performances, the presentation, are ritualistic in itself because it has to be that. It has to come from within. And usually I shy away from the settings that don't present me the opportunity of doing that. That's one reason why I haven't made it into the big hotels like in Vegas, you know.
Where, discourages that type of
still,
thing.
Most of my friends, you know, who are in the business, they say, look, go commercial, go commercial. I don't know what they mean. Why am I going commercial? Record companies will say, well, you have to change and do so and so and so and so. But it's very hard when you... I know the reason why I do what I do, and because I know sooner or later, if I don't do it right, you know, you will find out. You know, the truth will come out. One day, who knows, you find yourself somewhere in Africa and say, oh, look at that guy. He's really been jiving everybody. So really, and the truth is very bitter, and it really costs you a lot. But I don't mind because it will make you free. So, and I'm free. We do, you know, to answer your question specifically, when I really perform like I would do tonight, I do things that are ritualistic. You know, I would do dances that are ritualistic. Some people say, oh, look, the paper published with the Ebony, Jet magazine years ago, that the Olatunjis, that the elders were really mad at me, that I came over here and I started playing all those ritualistic rhythmic patterns, you know, and doing the ritualistic dances. That was in the 1960s.
Did it really matter? Did the magazine?
No, they have to do that to sell the magazine.
Right.
Well, there are some rhythmic patterns that are only played when, they say, when Obawaja, when the king never died. Nobody ever, you know, you are birthless, you are ageless and you are deathless. We never die. So they say the king, when the king disappeared, you know, and through the roof he went away, you know, he disappeared. His soul is gone somewhere. That's not a rhythmic pattern that has to be played. And when another king is going to be installed, you know, to replace him, that one which has left, there are certain rhythmic patterns that are played. So those rhythmic patterns, you don't play them for fun. No, that is just because the atmosphere is not the same. You know, so that's the only reason why it is not played. Like, I won't play bata rhythms in a concert setting, except if it is, you know, when we do what we call Salutation to the Gods, which is a new album, or similar to Drums of Passion, no instruments. I have a band now. Just trying to demonstrate to people that all we do is to make all the rest of the instrument play what you want them to play anyway. And whatever they are doing in disco, I did it in the 60s. Yeah.
Has it ever been hard for you to continue certain aspects of your spiritual life, living in America, living in New York?
Well, not New York. It's just been difficult. Not just in a society that when you read about the United States of America, when you are away from it, I mean, you feel so challenged. You want to really get here. When you read about what this country stands for. Justice, liberty, the pursuit of happiness for everybody. And what the founding fathers really put down, what was the motivating factors in the culture, and seeing it eroding away, the moral decadence, you know, and that frightens me a lot. And it's very hard for any child to grow up in this kind of environment. If even those who have really come from other cultures with fantastic background, they seem to just fall apart. If you will fall apart because of the changing patterns, you know, in our cultural institutions, or the emphasis on material things, the lack of what Albert Schweitzer called reverence for life. I mean, and it's unbelievable how easily someone can take another one's life. In the African culture, you know, because what they've written about Africa, I just can't believe it. Headhunters, so. The culture teaches, the tradition teaches that you have the power to kill, but you do not have the right. Two different things altogether. So when you know you have the power to take a life that you cannot create, then you don't have the right. Then you stop. And people have arguments, and they, you know, and for what people say, and people say, you know, I don't want to get into the social problems here or situations here about capital punishment and so and so. But the root of the whole thing is that we have to go right back and take a look at our institutions, the marriage institution, the religious institutions, just the family as an institution itself. Family not necessarily, you know, communal ownership of things. Family doesn't necessarily mean husband and wife and children. That's all we look for. And I believe that the whole idea of individualism has been stretched to the, to the most unbelievable end, individualism. Because our people say, Toba ba oju, aba imu, what affects the eye affects the nose. You see, because I have to think about, do I make you happy or do I make myself happy first? Then what, if I like what I'm doing, then definitely somebody will like it. But if I'm doing something that I don't like, I know somebody else out there is not going to like it. And I will have to do unto others as I would like them to do unto me.
You have created an African Cultural Center in New York. I believe it's located in Harlem.
Yes.
What kinds of things do you try to do within that? Who are you trying to reach? And what are you trying to tell them?
It's hard. Most people say, well, I set it up in Harlem because I set it up for blacks. And I say, no. I set it for all God, set it up for all God's children. When I came here, I read about Harlem. My first trip to Harlem was in 1950 as a freshman at Morehouse College. I went to tobacco farm to pick tobacco. I'd never done anything like that in my life, but I had to work during the summer to save money. I said, well, this is a good experience for me anyway. Get up and do something for yourself, you know, and see how hard it is to earn some money. Hard work. I came to New York, and I went to Harlem. I felt like I was at home. I said, well, this is the place, really. You know, in those days, you know, in 1950, when you write to Africa, first of all, it takes about 4 months before the letter is received, and another 4 or 5 months. So the reply to your letter might take a year before you get it, and you can't make a phone call. So I said, look, I am right here, and this is my home. And I found Harlem, the history that I read about, very great, great, great performers had their start in Harlem. And the image that Harlem really has been given to Harlem because of all of the social injustice and situations there, I wanted to change the image of Harlem, because Harlem was a place where both black and white used to go and look for the best talent. We read it. It's in the books. And I said, look, this is a great place. It is a great place. It's a place that has its own chemistry altogether. And that's why I put the school there. We have so many things downtown, Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, this and that. They're all downtown, so let people come uptown. And being an idealist, you know, it wasn't always that. People always say they are afraid to come to Harlem. And now we know that what happened in Harlem can happen at Times Square. So it is just a question of whether people want to participate, people want to bring about effective changes in our communities, in our different communities. That's why I put the school there. And I put it there so that African Americans, I don't want to call them blacks, because we have Italian Americans, Jewish American, Chinese American. And this is what has really made this country very, very unique. And there's no other place in the world like this place. For those of us, because we know, those of us who have traveled, people, intelligent people from all parts of the world has come here to make this place a very unique place indeed. And everybody has a part, has played a part in its development, in its success. And everybody, I believe, should be able to enjoy what comes out of it. And that's why I believe that it's a great place to put the school. And those who give me the excuses of not coming because they are afraid somebody might snatch their purse or somebody might mug them, they've forgotten one of the greatest sayings from one of your presidents. There's nothing to fear but fear itself.
What kinds of things do you teach at the school? Is it music, or is it also some of the spiritual aspects that you see in politics?
Well, I was one place that I used to go, and I had to leave. I used to commute to Boston to teach at the cultural center, you know, in Roxbury. And the head of the music department in that place actually got me fired because I refused to become a factory, you know, whereby I produced drummers that we just play for the dance company. He thought probably in 3 months I should be able to produce good drummers like myself. And this is, I've been doing this when I was 2 years old. So I asked him, I said, can you develop a classical pianist for an opera singer? You know, he said, well, this is not, you know, I'm not doing what I'm being paid for. So I had to leave. He said, so what I teach encompasses all of the tradition, the language. Those who have come to me and refuse to study the language, I stop teaching them. I stop teaching them. Because regardless of whatever they pay me, I can't bastardize the culture. We teach them how the culture has become a universal, or has contributed to the development of other cultures, or how it's related to other cultures. And not to superimpose African culture, but to show, like in the music, in the area of jazz, that Duke Ellington described as a phenomenon that has borrowed from so many different cultures and rhythm. And now people, what they call disco today, I don't know how the name come about, but You know, the background of the whole thing is rhythm. Rhythm is the soul of life. The whole universe revolves around in rhythm. And this is universal.
If I said to you, where's home, what country would it be? Would it be the home that you were born in Nigeria? Or has America become more of your home since you've more or less lived here since 1950?
Because of the stage of my development and my level of consciousness, I am a child of the universe. Right here now is my home, where I am right now. I'm going to make the best use of it. And if that is not forthcoming, I will take leave and find my good somewhere else. Of course, we say east, west, north, or south, home is the best. Of course, you want to remember your roots. That is it. It's already there. So I'm not worried. I know that. So I'm not searching for that. I know what it is. So wherever I am, I know that I'm in God's universe. You know, I could have been born in South Carolina. I could have been born in Johannesburg. I could have been born in Guyana or Suriname. I went to Trinidad and I performed at the Naparima Bowl, fantastic stage. On this stage, you are facing some people who have the money to pay $15, $20, and they have 5,000 seats behind you, you know, for people who can afford $2. I think it was a great thing, you know, with the result that I have to adjust myself in such a position so that I can give of myself to these two different people trying to separate. This is what is going on. People trying to draw a proper line of demarcation that we are so different. So my home is wherever I am, of course, with the roots back in Africa.
Have you been to Africa in the past few years?
Few years. I go 3 times a year.
Oh, you do?
Yes, I have to.
Has it seemed to have changed to you a lot since 1950 when you first came to the States?
Oh, yes. Every year there are changes, especially now that we are trying to rub shoulders with the rest of the world. We are now involved in the international politics. The whole continent is going through a fantastic change. Well, Victor Hugo once predicted that Africa would become the cynosure of all eyes. It has always been the cynosure of so many eyes, except that people in their imagination, you know, really just picture what Africa was like. The dark continent, it was called. But it's no longer dark, you see, because people are now beginning to know. People are now beginning to read between lines. People are now beginning to appreciate the contribution that Africa has made. And this is why it is the job of all people in the Western world or anywhere else to help to bring about a very, very wonderful change that will benefit all of us. The first atomic bomb that was made, the uranium, come from Africa. How many people know that Nigeria, my country, supply U.S. with 1 million barrels of oil, crude oil, every day, including Sunday? Why can't that be on the front page of the newspaper? Why does it have to be about somebody murdering somebody? Why can it be about what the relationship between all of these countries, you know, has produced to benefit both people on both parts of the side of the Atlantic? I think that's why I say the communication, what we have today, television, newspapers, radio, have a tremendous role to play in bringing about a better understanding, in bridging the gap that has existed between us for so long, in trying to help bring the standard of living that we know here so that to other people all around the world, because we have enough in the world. I don't go about what people are talking about, reducing the population. We are going to be starving in, you know, in year 2020. I know that we can feed everybody in the world, in this world right now, if we are not greedy. How much food are you going to eat? What most people really require is a decent place to live and a very nice place to lay their head, and that's it. Not everybody wants to become Rockefeller or Vanderbilt or whatever. People just want to live a simple life. People want to enjoy their stay and make this a pleasurable place to stay. Heaven on earth.
Yeah. We're going to be out of time in a moment, but in a couple of minutes, I'd really like to listen to an album that you recorded with Max Roach in around 1960, I guess it was.
Yes.
And as you said when you walked in, it's an album that's very hard to find. We're going to be listening to a piece called All Africa that was written by Max Roach and that you're featured on along with vocalist Abby Lincoln. I'd like to just talk a little bit about, before we hear it, your reactions to Afro-American drummers like Max Roach and what it was like when you met and shared your music and how you travel within jazz circles now.
Well, that was the biggest, one of the biggest treats for me. As I said before, I had no doubt in my mind that we had that in common. Because when I arrived in New York, in New Orleans, I'm traveling through New Orleans to Atlanta, Georgia, I heard some songs on radio in 1950. I said, now, who is that singing? I heard the blues. When I lost my baby, I almost lost my mind. I went to a gypsy to have my fortune there. I couldn't believe it because I know so many African songs that are just in that particular range, you know, that kind of feeling, you know. I said, now, and I take my drum and listen to the radio and, you know, play, just play along. So when I met Max Roach, Art Blakey, fantastic. Yeah, we've known each other for a long time. And in one of the tunes here, I wrote the words, you know, to the chant.
That's the one we're going to be hearing.
Oh, really? Yes.
Why don't you explain what's happening in the chant?
You see, for Max and Abby at that particular time, they were trying to reestablish. They wanted to say, look, we know that we have a heritage. We know that we are from somewhere. So we call the names of all of the different areas, all of the different tribes, all of the most important people. As we develop in some songs and discover that this has always been going on, like in the West Indies, in Calypso music, songs about people who have done great things, or whether you do good or bad, it will be recorded. Of course, in songs. And that's what we did in that particular tune, just like another tune, Bakule, you know, calling in the spirit of the ancestors or spirits of those who have departed but are still among us.
Well, before we hear this, I want to thank you very much, Babatunde Olatunji, for joining us this afternoon on Fresh Air. It's been a great, great pleasure to have you here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. And I should say, if you want to hear more of Olatunji, he will be performing this evening, and that will be at 7 o'clock in a concert that's sponsored by the Afro-American Cultural and Historical Museum. Because of the rain, the concert's going to be held indoors at the auditorium in Channel 12's new building, and that building is on 6th and Ray Streets. The exact address is 150 North 6th Street. The concert's at 7 o'clock. Also featured on the concert tonight will be two other African musicians, Elhaj Bai Kante and his son Dembo Kante. Now, they both play an African string instrument called the kora. And you may recall having heard them in the past couple of months here on Fresh Air. Is it okay if I give the address of your African Cultural Center in New
Please.
York, in case anyone wants to reach you through there or find out about the center?
Yes.
The address of that center is 43 East 125th Street in New York. That's in Manhattan.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
Can we change that to
875? 875?
West End Avenue, New York, New York, 10025.
Okay, and that's the Olatunji Center of African
Culture.
We're in
the process of moving from that previous address into a new building. So we're using the 875 address now, where we're really functioning from.
Okay, and if you want to...
operating from.
If you want to be at the concert this evening, if you'd like to telephone for more information, you can call 574-3600. 7-1. That's 574-3671, and that's the number of the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum, which is sponsoring this concert this evening at 7, and again, the concert's moved indoors into the Channel 12 building. Okay, we're going to hear now that recording with Olutunji and Abby Lincoln on the extended Max Roach composition, the Freedom Now Suite, and we'll hear Olutunji both on congas and doing the chants along with vocalist Abby Lincoln.
The beat has a rich and magnificent history, full of adventure, excitement, and mystery. Some of it bitter, and some of it sweet, but all of it part of the beat, the beat, the beat. They say it began with a chant and a hum and a black hand laid on a native drum.